BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Alex Krieger reads the final part of Jane's Fame, Claire Harmon's exploration of the global branding of Jane Austen. Today, Jane goes to Hollywood.
Just as Austen's novels had appealed strongly as candidates for illustration in the 19th century, so it was only a matter of time in the 20th before the film industry would turn to them too. Classic novels were powerfully fashionable in Hollywood in the 1930s and 40s. David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, and Wuthering Heights all became big box office hits. And though Austen lacked the drama of Dickens and the Brontes, she had the perfect credentials for light romantic comedy. Pride and Prejudice had emerged as the representative Austen novel, with its strong female lead, handsome hero, witty dialogue, and screwball, comic minor characters, it was an easy choice for Hollywood. When the war broke out, many of the British expats were encouraged to stay in Hollywood by the ambassador, Lord Lothian, who pointed out that the continuing production of films with a strong British tone is one of the best and subtlest forms of British propaganda. Robert Z. Leonard's 1940 Pride and Prejudice certainly had a strong British tone. Bringing Austen's beloved novel to the screen for the first time, and stuffed with British actors and accents, it both fed off and enhanced the cachet of British culture and tradition at a time when both were under threat. Aldous Huxley was working on the script in 1939 in an airless cubicle on the MGM lot in Hollywood. "One tries to do one's best for Jane Austen," he wrote, "but actually, the very fact of transforming the book into a picture must necessarily alter its whole quality in a profound way. The insistence upon story, as opposed to the diffuse irony which the story is designed to contain, is a major falsification of Miss Austen." Huxley's scruples about the adaptation didn't count for anything, it hardly needs mentioning. The producers insisted on simplifying the plot, dropping parts of the dialogue that were too literary, and inserting odd bits of new material. Huxley could hardly keep up with the required transformations and complained that, "I barely stopped my director from having Bennett fight a duel with Wickham." One completely arbitrary change was of the period of the action, which was moved on 40 years to justify more elaborate costumes. The designer, influenced by Gone with the Wind, felt that the fashions of 1815 didn't afford her enough scope. The resulting dresses were fantastically extravagant. The Bennett women hardly fit in the milliner's shop of the opening scene, they're wearing such huge hats and crinolines. And when Darcy and Elizabeth sit together on a bench, it is not Pride nor Prejudice which seems to keep them apart so much as their clothes. The finished film had the comforting theatrical look of many movies of the time, shot almost entirely in the studio with painted backdrops. And the film opened with a sort of verbal curtain. It happened in Old England. The fact that it was an American production of a British classic gently reflected the relation of the Allies in the war and the heritage that both countries were jointly defending. Audiences on both sides of the Atlantic could feel nostalgic for a period when the British Army and Navy beat off the threat of invasion, while genteel life went on at home uninterrupted, and the landed classes could meet and mate in peace. The first film of Pride and Prejudice may not have affected Jane Austen's literary standing one jot, but impressed millions of people with a complex sense of her importance. In the years after the war, Austen became the subject of choice for all the most ambitious literary critics. The Janeite torch was carried through this dark wood of new criticism by Lord David Cecil, the elegant old Etonian whose popular 1978 biography has never been out of print. He linked Austen firmly with the genteel, smiling southern landscapes, old parish churches, comfortable country houses, and the most attractive aspects of Regency decor, praising Chippendale and Sheraton chairs, Wedgwood and Worcester cups, not because there is any evidence that Jane Austen ever sat on the one or raised the other to her lips, but as examples of the peculiar amenity of life at the time, provided one was born English and in sufficiently easy circumstances. Cecil's heritage-heavy approach spoke powerfully to the masses of people beginning to take a somewhat proprietary interest in the huge range of stately homes that opened to the public in the 1970s and 80s. The cash-strapped gentry of the post-war world, forced to open the doors of their ancestral homes to the people, were regularly to be seen selling tickets of admission to their own drawing rooms on a Sunday afternoon. Far more vivid examples of living history than the costumed actors whom one encounters at most heritage sites today. All through the 70s and 80s, individual Austen novels went in and out of favour as the text of the moment in the Academy. Emma was a favourite in the years when psychoanalytic criticism predominated. Northanger Abbey played right into the hands of the emerging discipline of the history of the book, and Mansfield Park surged forward with the rise of post-colonial studies. Exponents of heteronormativity in Austen's work now vie with those who note its queerness. One provocatively titled essay, Jane Austen and the Masturbating Girl, caused a certain amount of controversy in 1993, but didn't reach the popular press, unlike a less sensational article by Terry Castle 2 years later, noting the whimsical yet fierce attachment in Jane's earliest letters to Cassandra and a kind of homophilic fascination in Austen's description of women generally. Castle concluded that both sisters found greater comfort and pleasure, more of that heartfelt felicity that Emma Woodhouse finds with Mr. Knightley, or Elizabeth Bennet with Darcy, in remaining with one another. When the magazine headlined the piece, "Was Jane Austen Gay?" Castle's argument became fair game for the press, some members of which chose to interpret the headline, if not the article, which was not read with as much care, as suggesting that the Austen sisters indulged in incestuous lesbian sex. There was outrage from the broadsheets to the tabloids. The outrage did not die down very quickly, as it was tempered with profound satisfaction at the spectacle of Castle, American, academic, and obviously crazed, getting England's Jane so wrong. Castle's employers, Stanford University, issued a news release attempting to calm the situation. Castle suggested politely that the depth of reaction in Britain was in proportion to Austen's iconic status in her homeland. Austen, Castle said, tends to be viewed as asexual, as not having had any sort of sensual life at all. But her novels, it seems to me, are about desire and eros and emotion. And if they weren't, why would we care about them? The late Victorian cult of Divine Jane has persisted in the popular imagination despite the many radically revisionist 20th century views. A genuinely popular author, as well as a great one, she has come to exist in several mutually exclusive spheres at once. What appears to one reader as a biting satire on 18th century provincial life is read by another purely for its nostalgia value. The feminist message of, say, Pride and Prejudice translates as a paean to the virtues of the status quo. She has truly become all things to all men. Austen's narrowness has paradoxically been a major factor in her global mobility. Before the war, she was published in about a dozen languages, but in the following 30 years, propelled by film and other new media, she was translated into Japanese, Hebrew, Icelandic, Russian, Persian, Bengali, Finnish, Chinese, Arabic, as well as many minor tongues such as Tamil and Telugu. The three or four families in a country village formula in plots dealing almost exclusively with money and marriage speaks to millions the world over. Austen's most empathetic readers may well be in modern-day Africa, where the Church of England is at its most traditional and where family structures still resemble those familiar to the author. Bride and Prejudice, the 2004 Bollywood adaptation, tapped into the same relevance to contemporary Sikhs, a relevance lost to contemporary Westerners. But the main reason for Austen's mass popularity is the one from which critics tend to avert their eyes: the love stories. More than half of all paperbacks published in 2004 were romances, and Jane Austen is the acknowledged mother of the genre, many of which, like the works of Georgette Heyer and Barbara Cartland, return to Regency settings to get closer to their model. There are, of course, no raised heart rates and certainly no kisses in any of Austen's novels, but the very absence of explicit eroticism leaves her books charged with sexual feeling, mostly of the young, virginal and, therefore rather sex-obsessed heroines, though the male character's feelings are indicated too, through restlessness, Frank Churchill, meaningful looks, Wentworth, and agitated silences, Mr. Knightley. Austen's heroes, or men, for they aren't in truth very heroic, have often been complained of for being rather two-dimensional creatures. They're so non-threatening that a conscientious screenwriter such as Andrew Davis has felt it necessary to introduce scenes of manly pursuits in his adaptations, to inject into his scripts some of the testosterone that Austen has always left out. In Davies' Sense and Sensibility, Brandon does some shooting and falconry, Edward Ferrars swings his axe at the firewood, and they all gallop around furiously on steaming stallions when suffering from the disappointments of Austen's delayed gratification plots. The most remarkable turn in Austen's global fame has been the popularity of film and television versions of her work in the past 15 years, beginning with the BBC's 1995 Pride and Prejudice. The beloved story, reproduced in more detail than ever before, sprang to life with remarkable freshness. 40% of the UK's total viewing audience tuned in to witness its happy ending, and Colin Firth playing Darcy became the nation's number one heartthrob, a position he, or rather he as the character, retains virtually unchallenged to this day. If Austen's Pride and Prejudice is now regularly voted the nation's favourite book, it is in great part because it is the book of the film. Suddenly, Jane Austen was everywhere. The Wall Street Journal spoke of Austen mania, and Entertainment Weekly was moved to write, "She doesn't go to the CNBC in parties. She's reticent with the press. There are nasty rumours that she engaged in an incestuous relationship with her sister, for God's sake. And frankly, she could use a makeover. But in this year alone, four of her novels have been adapted for the big and small screens. And with numerous worldwide websites devoted to her glory, she even holds her own with internet pin-up Brad Pitt. Not bad for a British broad who's been dead for 178 years. Harriet Martineau, writing in 1837, identified a feeling which now pervades thousands of Austen internet blogs, that Austen's characters are the unrivaled, intimate friends of the whole public. Individual bloggers can now see the whole of life through their reading and appropriation of the books. Austen Prose, a daily celebration of the brilliance of Jane Austen's writing, is particularly prolific and engaged. Other blogs seek to provide something like a service through their personal enthusiasm, such as Jane Austen Quote of the Day. One of the many breakaway fan clubs is the archly self-mocking Republic of Pemberley, whose members divide literature into two categories, Jane Austen books and non-Jane Austen books. Their online shop sells Jane totes and t-shirts that parade a self-conscious irony, and the Republic claims to be your haven in a world programmed to misunderstand obsession with things Austen. Other fans are much less self-conscious. At the Jane Austen shop in Bath, you can buy embroidery sets, pencils, an oil-painted image of Colin Firth as Darcy printed on canvas, and also reproduction muslin dresses and bonnets for those who like to look authentic at conventions. There's also a selection of gentlemen's cravats and a popular nightshirt range. No Darcy pillowcases yet, but that would be a logical extension of the franchise. The significance of Jane Austen is so personal and so universal, so intimately connected with our sense of ourselves and of our whole society, that it is impossible to imagine a time when she or her works could have delighted us long enough. What would Jane Austen have made of all of this?
Jane's Fame by Claire Harmon was read by Alex Krieger. It was abridged by Polly Coles and produced by Clive Brill. It was a Pacificus production for the BBC.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock now. Painful sacrifices have to be made in our drama Two on a Tower next. Mel Gedroych wraps up our short story fortnight with the last of Paul Jennings' Unpredictable Tales. She also goes hunting for flotsam and jetsam on the beach. That's in the 4 o'clock show. And a little later, Humphrey Lyttelton takes us through the next chapter of his life in Play As I Please at 6:30. Now, the concluding part of Two on a Tower by Thomas Hardy, adapted for radio by John Senn, with original music composed by Philip Giler. Lydie Vivette is dying. She's committing her memories to paper for her young son Joshua and recalls the happy times that followed her secret marriage to the handsome young astronomer Swithin St. Cleeve.
Each of us has a moment, my son. The moment that we return to as the time of our lives. You are before yours, but it will find you. And before you know it, it will have disappeared like sand through your hands. Those 2 weeks following our secret wedding were the sweetest and happiest of our lives, before the complications of the real world crashed down upon us.
Two on a Tower by Thomas Hardy, adapted for radio by John Senn.
I never realised the house was so big.
And yet there is something so sad about the house, don't you think? Especially in this east wing, which has not seen life nor soul since before Sir Blunt and I were married.
When I was a boy, there was a party here every weekend. The entire house was thrown open to gaiety.
It will never be so again, unless you earn your fortune. The estate is saddled with debt, and I have nothing but a little private income on which to survive.
And you are bound to occupy this house?
Or lose everything. It was stipulated in the will.
And in the event of your remarriage...
The will did not say.
Oh, well, I'm glad that you're losing nothing by marrying me.
And I hope you lose nothing either. Or at least anything of consequence.
What have I to lose?
Your liberty. When you achieve success as a great physicist in polite society, and better offers come from bright young women, will you not regret this? Will you not despise me, your old wife?
Does that answer your question?
Shh, we must be quiet now, my love. Mr. Fellows will be fast asleep, just the other side of the chapel wall.
An empty chapel never fails to awe.
Built by the same ancestor of Sir Blunt's who built your column.
My column?
It is yours now. Everything you see is as much yours as it is mine.
What irony. An agnostic such as I owning a chapel.
Don't say such things, even in jest.
It's true. Science is my god. I have never even been confirmed.
But why?
Well, I hardly know. The confusion resulting from the death of my father caused it to be forgotten, I suppose.
Dear Swithin, will you do this to please me? Be confirmed when the bishop next visits Welland. Word has it that there may be confirmations next month.
Since I have done without the virtue of it for so long, might I not do without it altogether?
No. Why do you not care about such serious matters? Without the church to cling to, what do we have?
Each other.